Dittrich and Mercedes Martin-Benito here at PI, which is now today about faces of analog spinform models. And to get started, I just want to give you a very, very sloppy introduction to spinforms, where you can see spinforms as a particle approach related to loop quantum gravity. And for those who are not familiar, you can consider them as generalized lattice gauge theories, for example, defined on SO4 or SO2C. And if you consider the Lebesgue action of continuous gravity, you usually start with some BF term in front, which is a topological theory and describes gravity in three dimensions. But in order to get to a theory with propagating degrees of freedom, you have to introduce so-called simplicity constraints via Lagrange multiplier phi. And if you do so, you return to the normal first-order formulation of gravity. And this action is actually important because it is underlying the construction scheme of spinform models. Instead of directly implementing the Lebesgue action, in spinform models, people start with usual BF theory because they know how to discretize and quantize the theory. And then on this discretized level, they impose the simplicity constraints. And in principle, there are many ambiguities how to impose these simplicity constraints in your model, which results then in several different spinform models that are available on the market. And from the perspective of lattice gauge theories, best pictorially, you would start with a theory which is the weak coupling limit of, for example, Young-Mills theory. We would call it BF theory or the ordered phase. The other phase in lattice gauge theories you can usually find is the strong coupling or the degenerate phase. And by imposing the simplicity constraints, you end up somewhere in between. And the question now is, if I have a very refined lattice, I have very many of my basic building blocks around, what is the effective theory I have if I don't look at the fine-grained details, so to speak? So, and eventually, what is the relation of spinform models to general relativity? So on the level of one basic building block, we know that if you look at a very large building block, they oscillate like the Reggie action. So there is a relation to discrete gravity. But we do not know what happens if we have many building blocks. And the question I want to address today is, do there exist sort of continuum phases of analog spinform models that at least implement some version of simplicity constraints? That would be like a first naive check whether these models can have something to do with general relativity. And because spinforms are very complicated, I look at analog spinform models today, which you can understand as dimensionally reduced spinform models. And they're actually what one calls a vertex model defined on a graph or 2D lattice. And they actually have very similar dynamical ingredients as spinform models. For example, they allow for simplicity constraints. So what are these dynamical ingredients? So on each edge of my lattice, I have, it basically carries three different labels, an irreducible representation and two magnetic indices if I consider non-abelian groups. And this is the Hilbert space, the L2 space of that group. So the direct sum of all irreducible representations, Vj, tensor Vj star. And additionally, each edge carries an edge weight, which we call omega e. And the real important ingredient is this PV sitting on the vertex. This PV is a projector onto the invariant subspace of the tensor product of irreducible representations meeting at that vertex. Now, the important difference to standard lattice gauge theories is that for spinform models, you actually have a projector onto a smaller subspace due to the imposition of simplicity constraints. And then your model is defined by its partition function, where you sum over all irreducible representations. You have your edge weights associated to the edges and your projectors associated to the vertices. And actually, in this talk, we define this all on the quantum group SE2K, which has the nice property that we have a cutoff on the representation labels. But for this talk, this is actually not important because I will not talk about those details. What I rather want to talk about is that you can rewrite this model as a tensor network. And this is basically just on this local level, we translate what I just told you about into a tensor. So we assign an object with four indices, or let's just one index for each of these edges this vertex has to the vertices, and each of these index labels runs over the indices I previously assigned to the edges. And then you can express your partition function basically as a contraction of a tensor network. So this is sort of a nice rewriting of the problem. What is it good for? Because I haven't addressed the elephant in the room. What happens if I have a very large network which I have to contract now? So the idea is maybe I don't have to contract such a large network. Maybe it is good enough if I can just look at a coarser network, which approximates my partition function very well. So I would have to define some tensor T prime, which approximates then this partition function very well. And if I do it again, I may define some tensor T double prime, which is then just on a very, very coarse lattice. So the idea is that I want to basically compute the partition function in steps by defining effective tensors T prime, T prime prime, which describe the effective dynamics of my system. And we are not really interested in the partition function, but rather these effective building blocks, which are supposed to be the effective building blocks of space-time. And the intricate part is, what I did not tell you, what are these indices around here? So tensor network renormalization brings us into the realm of real space renormalization techniques. Thank you. Because what we would like to do, we would like to define effective dynamics at different scales or different refinement steps of our model. And if you do it infinitely many times, we eventually arrive at a fixed point which describes the continuum dynamics of our system. The problem is that for a very long time, real space renormalization techniques were rather limited because you usually encounter non-local couplings. And in order to continue with your scheme, you have to introduce truncations or approximations, which are where the error you make is very difficult under control. So one very well-known example is the scheme by Mikhtar and Kardanov, which is quite brutal in the sense that it outright removes the non-local couplings directly. So what we are rather focusing on are new developments from condensed matter theory and quantum information, in particular tensor network renormalization. And they are based on the idea that you are identifying which degrees of freedom are actually relevant. So if you would look at a transfer matrix formalism, you could imagine that you want to time evolve a system many, many, many times. And at each step of these transfer matrix, you would introduce an orthonormal basis. And this orthonormal basis then comes with an eigenvalue assigned to these orthonormal modes. And if you do this time evolution many times, you argue that only the maximal eigenvalue is actually important. So like this, you want to approximate your dynamics. So this is also what is underlying tensor network renormalization. So the actual algorithm we use is we have a four-valent square lattice, and we divide our tensors up into even and odd ones. And then depending on that, we basically split the vertices either like this or like that. And once we've done that, we have like these little black squares of our old degrees of freedom, which we then contract into a new effective tensor. And the splitting is actually performed via a singular value decomposition. So we group the legs of our tensors into pairs, which gives us the matrix. And on that matrix, we can always apply a singular value decomposition, which gives us an exact variable transformation. So the additional advantage is that we have these singular values in the middle. These singular values are ordered by size. So the first one is the largest one, and they always get smaller until you end up when they're all larger than zero. And they basically tell you how relevant a degree of freedom is. And what you see, I mean, you can basically do it like this and keep on going. But what you see is, in the end, your index range and the number of singular values you get grows exponentially with each coarse-graining step. So you have to introduce a truncation. But now you know which degrees of freedom are important. So you basically say, well, I approximate this by only taking the largest chi singular values. And this chi is, in condensed matter literature, referred to as the bond dimension. So the bond dimension tells you how accurate your numerical simulations will actually be. And once you've made this truncation, you contract your four-valent or your little black squares, and you end up with new effective tensors on a new course of four-valent letters. And some additional thing I want to talk about is that I defined this spin networks, or the spin nets, on a group, on an underlying group. So these tensors usually come with lots of structure. If I perform the singular value decomposition on the whole matrix, this is usually very, very inefficient. And additionally, I lose the interpretation of the variables, because then they just come with numbers 1, 2, 3. So I would like something different. So what you can do is you can bring this matrix into a block diagonal form. This is you do some you do a bit of group theory, and you realize, well, these blocks of, are actually labeled by a pair of two spins, J and J prime, which we call the intertwiner channel. And then you perform the SVD for each of these channels, select the most relevant singular values, and you realize after this truncation, I have a more general Edge-Hilbert space. So before I just had Vj tensor Vj prime as a direct sum over all the j's, and now I have a certain multiplicity index. So an intertwiner channel can appear multiple times, and in general, I now have Vj tensor Vj prime. So this is a generalization because I, in principle, allow this j prime to be different from j star. And the important thing is, from the excited intertwiner channels, I can determine the phases of my model. So talking about phases, it's time to show a phase diagram for the concrete example of SU28. So first of all, these parameters I show you here correspond to different implementations of the simplicity constraints. And actually, they are actually in a linear combination. So according to the choice of initial parameters, the system flows to a different fixed point, which is indicated by a different color here. So we find non-trivial fixed points. By non-trivial, I mean they have an implementation of these simplicity constraints, which you see here in green and orange. And each of these fixed points actually comes with an extended phases. So the first message is we find more structure than in standard lattice gauge theories. And of course, you want to know what these fixed points mean. So actually, all the fixed points represent topological theories, which is sort of inherent from the coarse graining scheme we use. And in green, you see what we call factorizing fixed points, where actually the two representations we see completely decouple. If that would occur in a spinform model, that would mean that your basic building blocks completely decouple, which is sort of not a nice feature to have. In blue, you see a standard lattice gauge theory phase, which is exactly the BF phase, which is characterized by only J, the pairs J, J star are allowed, which you would compare, or which you would understand as a maximal gluing of your building blocks. And in orange, there's something we call mix, because we like a better name for it, which is sort of in between, which is, it is not BF, it is not factorizing, so we don't really know what it really is. But you see a nice interplay between decoupling and gluing, which is due to the imposition of the simplicity constraints. And of course, you may say, well, these are all topological theories. What does that, what could that possibly have to do with gravity? Well, we have indications that these phase transitions you see here are actually of second order. So there you see more and more degrees of freedom become relevant, and hopefully you might get propagating degrees of freedom. But also at that point, this, our coarse graining scheme breaks down because they necessarily have to truncate. So if you let me come to my conclusions. Today, I just presented briefly a coarse graining scheme for analog spinform models. And we have very encouraging results, actually, that we find a very rich fixed point structure with extended phases, which is really beyond the standard lattice gauge theory phases. And we see that the intertwiner channels are really the relevant degrees of freedom in these models. And we also expect them to be relevant in spinform models. And we observe this interplay between like a certain gluing and decoupling of your building blocks according to how you impose the simplicity constraints. And we have indications that there are second order phase transitions between these different phases. And as an outlook, the very next step could be that we study not just SE2K spin nets, but SE2K cross SE2K spin nets, because that would be the underlying symmetry group of, for example, the Barrett-Crane model. And another thing we are working on is to develop an algorithm actually for the full spinform models. And that's actually necessary to see whether you find similar fixed points and similar phases for these models as well. And then we have to understand what happens at the phase transition. So there's a lot of stuff to go, but I think this are very nice first indications that the whole spinform program might work. So I would like to thank you for your attention.